Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press and the Hellas Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with photographer Tina Freeman, whose new book is Lamentations. A New Orleans Museum of Art curator of photography, Russell Lord, joins us. We'll also hear from Robert Mann, whose new biography is Becoming Ronald Reagan, The Rise of a Conservative Icon. It's a great pleasure to welcome Tina Freeman to The Reading Life. Tina is one of New Orleans' best-known photographers, and her new exhibit at the New Orleans Museum of Art reveals her urgent and beautiful preoccupation with climate change. Tina Freeman, Lamentations, is the accompanying book. Also with us is Russell Lord, who is the curator of photographs at the New Orleans Museum of Art. Tina, welcome.
Thank you so much, Susan, for having me. And Russell.
And Russell, welcome.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, as always.
Now, Tina, I remember a while back when we were in a bookbinding class together, and you talked about these photographs and your obsession with vanishing ice of the polar regions. And they were just mesmerizing photographs. And now, paired with photographs of vanishing Louisiana landscape, they're mesmerizing in an entirely new way.
Well, thank you. In 2011, I'm not sure when we did the bookbinding class, but in 2011, I started the photographs of the ice.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 2013, I started the images of the wetlands. Almost right away, I began to see the visual connections. Of course, there are the connections in water.
Yes.
And water moving from one place, being the ice, into the other, being our wetlands.
And vanishing ice, vanishing land, so yes. Much loss. Oh. So what is it like for you to look at your work in that way? Do you start thinking of photographs in pairs? Do you start looking to echo image after image?
I can't say that there was one specific way of seeing the pairs. Some of the images, I knew that I wanted to find a pair for it. For instance, the iceberg that has the curve.
Mm-hmm.
I went out into the wetlands to find its pair because I love that iceberg. There were other icebergs that I love, but there weren't necessarily such direct correlations that I could find. But and then sometimes I would just see them. I did some speed pairing where I would go through hundreds of images within a short period of time and try to come up with pairs, but that didn't work. It was the long-term working with the images that brought through the pairs. And there are a couple of images that have two or three pairs,
mm-hmm.
possible pairs. And it was interesting to see Russell ended up doing the final selection, and it was interesting to see which ones he paired, did the final pairing with on those. In a way, I'd almost like to have all of the pairs somewhere. You know, I mean, uh-huh. put that on a website or something like that, just so you can see a little bit of the process mm-hmm. of how to do it.
So, Russell, when you get involved in a project like this, at what point do you become involved? And then how do you know how hard to push and when to step back and which pair to pick?
Well, I got involved on this project fairly early on. I mean, I first saw some of the images of ice 5 years ago, right around then. So it was shortly after she began making them. But as a curator, I am very interested in letting the artists speak through mm-hmm. their work. And so even though I selected some specific pairs, I like to say that I had nothing but good choices good options to choose from, because each pair said something different, but they were all saying something powerful. And in some cases, it was really a choice by committee. Tina was there and I was there and we were together and I would ask a lot of questions. So I tried to never push an artist because I think we as curators are facilitators. And mm-hmm. the whole point is to find out what Tina's message is. So I ask questions to get to that point and then hopefully guide the project towards the clearest articulation of that message in mm-hmm. the end.
One of the things that strikes me about these photographs, and this is where you can tell me if I'm way off base, but it's like these pairs are almost literal shapes of loss. You can see different patterns, like the way a glacier will have lace like eaten away at the edges, the way the wetlands have that terrible, lacy, watery intrusion. And then some photographs have this great hole at the center with what's been lost. And so if it's almost as if you stand back and look at them, you're looking at, this is the way we lose things. This is the way we lose things, slowly, quickly. It's a variety of experiences of loss. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. I hope everybody takes away their own interpretation of what's happening. But for me, when I started the project, climate change was really so much of a perhaps unknown. I mean, a lot of people felt that it wasn't real for whatever reason, and I could go into that.
And that would be another show.
Yeah. I mean, actually, a lot of the same people that pushed the fact that smoking was not harmful to health
right.
were the very same people that were saying that there's no consensus with climate change.
Sad, yeah. but true.
Yeah, it is very sad. And it's the confusion that is out there is tragic, and we need to get on with this pretty mm-hmm. quickly.
Now, one of the things that interests me about this book and these photographs, looking at them, is that a lot of us are never going to have the chance to see polar ice. We're only going to see the erosion of the wetlands when we drive to Grand Isle or drive to South Louisiana. But it's like with these photographs, you've given us a place to stand. You know what I mean? When you're looking at the photograph and here's this glacier in all its austere, separated beauty, you're there. You really feel that you're there. So where were you? I mean, were you on a boat? Were you like, I mean, how close were you? Tell me what it's like to photograph. What's that experience
when
like?
When you're in the extreme Arctic and Antarctic, the easiest way to be there is on a boat. And Antarctica, there is no other way to do it unless mm-hmm. you're a scientist and are working with the National Science Foundation and maybe have a grant to be on land and stay at one of the bases. But most people that go down there are on a boat.
And you went on a boat with more than 80 other photographers. What was that like?
It was my first trip. And it was a huge step for me, and it was fabulous. It was really a great way to be there because the boat's entire purpose was to photograph ice mm-hmm. rather than animals. And there's a big difference in the way you go about the two. For instance, if you want ice, you go early in the season, meaning November, early December. If you want penguins and chicks and that kind of thing, you go in the middle of the season, so January. Maybe even February. So it's harder to get there earlier because it's a little bit more dangerous and the mm-hmm. weather's not as good. But the ice is amazing. And it's fascinating to see other people who are on the trips, images of the very same icebergs that I photographed. And I know some of these people have been on dozens of trips, but they're still using some of the photographs of that very first trip.
Mm-hmm.
So we had really great ice.
84 people.
Well, that's a small ship.
I mean,
it's hard to find a ship that small now because the ships are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And I would say to anybody that would like to go to Antarctica and wants to make a plan to go to Antarctica, to go on the smallest ship they can find mm-hmm. because there are a lot of restrictions on the larger ships. If it's 200 or more people, you'll never land. You'll just have to stay on the ship and float around. I think maybe you can still cruise icebergs. I'm not even sure you can do that. When you have the smaller and smaller ships, you have a much greater freedom. And the last time I went, there were five passengers. It was a sailboat, a 74-foot sailboat. And five passengers, we had three crew. We had a naturalist and a member of his office. And there, we could just be moving down between glaciers or between islands and say, oh, that looks like a good spot. Let's stop over there and go over there. Whereas the bigger ships, they have to decide months ahead exactly where they're going, and there's no chance of change because they're trying to make the illusion that there are not very many other ships out there. Uh-huh. So, you know, you won't see another ship except for maybe in the far distance for 20 minutes or so.
I have this vision of you all hanging over the side with your cameras all lined up.
Everybody fighting for position, the right spot. You know? Yeah.
Well, there was a lot of lining up on the side, and I'm sure the ship was listing in some of those instances, but there wasn't ever a time when you couldn't find a spot.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with photographer Tina Freeman, author of Lamentations, and NOMA curator Russell Lord.
So this was the work of many hands to put together this exhibit.
Yes, I work better in a collaboration, yes.
So talk about some of the other people who contributed.
The people that put these trips together. I mean, because it meant that I was put in a place that someone else thought was a good place to be, except not so much in the wetlands, but there too, yes. I mean, I had a guide at Avoca that brought me to locations.
Yeah, you've talked a little bit about people who brought you on boats, pilots on planes.
Oh, yeah. The pilot in Iceland was incredible. He literally put me in the spot. He's an Icelandic air pilot, and he knows his country very, very well. And we would be flying really low. This was the first time I'd really ever done aerial photography, and I went with a friend, and I was in the back of the plane. So he said, take off your seatbelt. And he would do these circles where I was literally slammed against the door thinking, and this was little Cessna planes with tin can doors, wondering, am I going to fall out of this door? But he would put us right in the location and keep going around until we had gotten what we wanted. And then we could say, you know, we'd like to go over there or whatever. But he really knew the locations. And that was true with so many places. I mean, my guide in Avoca was like that. He really knew the island, and he would bring me to certain places. So that's a collaboration with the guides. Mm-hmm. I had a guide in Lake Foss Point, which is where the ancient cypress tree is. And then collaborations with Russell, with Morgan Malthrop, who is my collaborator on the last book. Mm-hmm. There's so many different people. I can't even think of everybody right this minute. But John Williams and I go out to the wetlands together. And
in the book, we also have contributions from David Muth, who is the head of coastal restoration for the National Wildlife Foundation, and Brent Goering, who's an assistant professor at Tulane and studies glaciers. So it was great to have this kind of informed perspective on these two halves of the project.
Oh, brief, but so important, really. Well, it's not lost on me, Tina, that your last word in this book is hope.
Yes, there is hope, and there are things that we can do. We just need to do them pretty quickly.
Okay. Well, we should all look at these photographs and get busy, don't you think?
Yes.
We've been talking with photographer Tina Freeman and NOMA curator Russell Lord about the new book and new exhibit, Tina Freeman Lamentations, up at NOMA until March 8th, 2020. Tina, Russell, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Susan.
Bob Mann is a journalist and political historian who holds the Manship Chair of Journalism at the Manship School of Mass Communication at Louisiana State University. He's written for the Monroe News Star, the Shreveport Journal, and the Times-Picayune, and has worked for U.S. Senators Russell Long, John Breaux, and J. Bennett Johnson, and was communications director for Governor Kathleen Babineau Blanco. Today, we're talking about his new book, Becoming Ronald Reagan, The Rise of a Conservative Icon. Bob, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan. Good to be with you.
It's so interesting to me that in your professional life, you've worked for so many Democrats, yet in your scholarly life, you've written so much about Republicans. Your book, Daisy Petals in the Mushroom Clouds, LBJ, Barry Goldwater, and the Ad That Changed American Politics, was one of the best political books of 2011 chosen by the Washington Post. So what is it about Republicans that's taking up your writing energy?
Well, it's not so much Republican or Democrat. I wrote the first few books that were about the U.S. Senate, which I knew a lot about, having worked in the Senate and Senate history. And it just so happened that the major characters in the drama over civil rights and the drama over the Vietnam War were Democrats, because the Democrats were largely in the White House during those periods and running the Congress. It wasn't really so much I was writing about Democrats as I was writing about issues that Democrats had a lot more to do with. The last couple of books that I've written now have dealt with the 1964 presidential race between Lyndon Johnson and Barry Goldwater. And that race, I think, is underrated for a lot of different reasons. And I'm fascinated by what happened in that race and what it meant for American politics going forward. And my fascination with that contest led me to go deeper into Reagan's impact on that race and then Reagan's impact on American politics and how he got to be the conservative that we all know, having been a very liberal Democrat in his early career. So I'm more interested in these races, and it just so happened a lot of them were Democrats, but now a Republican was in my sights.
Mm-hmm. Now, you concentrate on a very specific compressed time period, his Hollywood years up to the nomination of Senator Barry Goldwater for the presidency. And it creates a narrative drive because you really see him heading towards something all the way.
That's kind of the fun thing about biography, is that the reader is, in many cases, and certainly in this case, the reader is already sort of in, at least on where it's going. They know that this guy ends up being president of the United States. So I'm writing about someone who is in the beginning stages of his political awakening, his evolution from liberal to conservative, finding himself exploring these issues in a way that, to him, he has no idea he's going to be president. We all know he's going to be president. And that's one of the fun things to me about biography, is that we know something that the protagonist doesn't even know.
Now, I'm old enough to remember Reagan on TV with General Electric Theater and Death Valley Days and all that. And one of the fascinating parts of this book is the way you chronicle Reagan's long apprenticeship as a speechmaker for GE, which gave him grassroots political experience and a huge following before he ever got into politics. And I love that historian who called it the greatest accidental political training ever.
It was. And, you know, the thing about Reagan, people who only know him as the actor, the movie actor of the 30s and 40s, when his career was primarily, when he was most robust as an actor and making movies, think that his success in politics was because of his acting experience. And I don't discount his acting experience as a factor in his political success. I think that there is a part to explore there. But what people don't fully realize is what he was doing in the 50s when his movie career was on the skids, and he was working for General Electric, hosting General Electric Theater, but more importantly, roaming around the country, visiting these GE plants and speaking to employees and speaking to civic groups and chambers of commerce and all these groups in these little small towns, giving speeches and gradually making the speeches more political in nature. And the apprenticeship that was for him, what he learned about politics, what he learned about reading an audience, what he learned about giving a speech, what he learned about just learning about policy, learning about these issues. He was an inveterate reader. He was a voracious reader, something that I didn't fully realize, how many books he consumed and the kind of information he consumed and how he wrote his own speeches. And all of that is a part of Reagan's life that I don't think that many people realize. When they give the credit to his acting career, they're not fully aware of what the more important part, the more important apprenticeship was, those GE years.
There was one actor who complained that he wasn't that much fun on the set because he was always reading and studying.
Larry Williams was the actor who had starred with him in a couple of movies and wrote A Remembrance many years later. But there were other people who knew Reagan, who worked with Reagan, who were either actors, co-stars, or who observed him on the set, who talked about how insufferable he was in a way, because he, you know, most actors kind of wanted to retreat to their trailers or to a corner and take a nap or read a book or, you know, just goof off. Reagan wanted to talk politics. Reagan wanted to talk issues, and you know, a lot of actors didn't want to do that. They didn't really want to be educated in the issues of the day. You know, some people found it charming, and a lot of people found it annoying, but it was a characteristic of Reagan in those early years that he really was interested in politics.
Well, tell us about some of the books that mattered to him.
So when he went to work for GE, there was a guy named Lemuel Boulware, who was the head of employee relations for GE, who started sending him a lot of books on economics. And these weren't heavy tomes or anything, but he started sending him all these books on economics and articles about labor relations. And Reagan was very eager to sort of imbibe the GE culture and to learn as much as he could about the GE philosophy in dealing with labor. Now, you got to remember that Reagan was a labor leader. He had been the president of the Screen Actors Guild. He had represented the screen actors in labor negotiations. And now he was on the other side and learning a philosophy that was not all that kind to labor, was not all that favorable to organized labor. There were a lot of union members who worked for GE. And Boulware, I think, as much as anybody, pulled him to the other side through these readings of these very conservative economic books that showed Reagan a different side. And Reagan was really eager to please. He was really eager to conform to the GE culture. And it was those books on economics that I think changed him as much as anything.
But in later days in his life, people would confront him about stories in his speeches and, you know, actual events. And he didn't always have a grasp of the facts. He couldn't always back things up.
One of the characteristics that I noticed very quickly about Reagan in looking at his speeches is that he was not careful. He had a lot of information, and he collected a lot of information, and he wrote a lot of information down. Those stories and those facts and figures found their way into his speeches and writings, newspaper columns that he might write at the time. But when I started looking to find where he got this information, sometimes, for example, I'll give you a good example. Reagan, for almost 10 years, was going around giving these speeches talking about the divorce rate in Hollywood being much lower than the national divorce rate. And he was citing these numbers. He was throwing out a percentage of the divorce rate in Hollywood. And I tried to figure out where did he get this number. He repeated it for almost 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I finally found that he found it in a survey that was conducted for the Hollywood Reporter in 1949. And the numbers were bad when they were collected. They weren't accurate. There were better sources for the number. The Census Bureau had more accurate numbers. But Reagan was repeating these numbers into the late 1950s as if they were fresh new numbers. And that was indicative of a pattern. He would acquire some bit of information, a story that he believed, whether it was true or not. Maybe he got it from a friend. Maybe he got it from Reader's Digest. But once that story got into his repertoire, it almost never left. And so I found stories that just were not true. They were factually incorrect that Reagan regularly told for over 20 years into his presidency.
So what do you think your book tells us that's useful for our current political climate? Because that's why we read these books.
I think we have a tendency to discount Reagan as a lightweight because he was an actor. I have a lot of problems with Reagan's policies when he was president and before. There's not much I agree with Reagan on. But I don't think it was a problem to elect an actor, a former actor, governor, or even president. I think that Reagan, for all the problems that he had in telling these stories that weren't entirely correct, he still did the work. He read the books. He did his own reading. He did his own thinking in many cases. Not all, but he thought this stuff out. He went around the country and gave these speeches and listened to audiences and talked to people about these issues. He cared deeply about these issues. And when he began to run for governor of California, and certainly when he began to run for president a few years later, these were issues that he knew by heart. Maybe he knew the wrong things about them. Maybe he didn't know the issues like a policy expert would, but these weren't new to him. He was not a phenomenon in American politics because he was an actor. He did the work. What I see in people like Donald Trump, and maybe we could name some other people who've jumped from the entertainment world into politics, is that they didn't do the work. With Trump, it shows almost every day that he's not familiar with these issues. He's never really brought himself up to speed on these issues. He's not a curious person. He hasn't done the work like someone like Reagan did. And I think they're in different stratospheres. Sure, they both came out of entertainment, but their experiences before getting into politics are just radically different.
Is that what you most admired about Reagan as you did this book?
Yeah, well, that, and the other thing that I was surprised by was just how personably likable I found him to be. It's almost become trite to talk about his optimism and his love of country. And while I don't agree with his policies, I came away admiring how much he respected the democratic process, how much he respected people in general. You know, one thing you don't find in Reagan's writings or his speeches are personal attacks on people. Even when he could go after a bureaucrat, he would make that person nameless and faceless. He sort of blanched at the personal attack. He is also the person who helped create the myth and the stereotype of the welfare queen, so I'm not saying that his record is blameless, but in general, I admire him for not making personal attacks. And also, I think Reagan had a real optimism that rhetoric, that speeches, that getting people to care about politics, that I can persuade you. I'm not going to get you to vote for me by attacking the other guy, by vilifying people. I'm going to woo you and bring you to me. I'm going to persuade you to see things my way instead of persuading you that the other person is a bad person.
He was called the great communicator, but someone said he should really have been called the great persuader.
Yeah, that was Lou Cannon, who, a longtime biographer, covered him in California and at the White House for the Washington Post. And I thought it was a great observation that he really was the great persuader.
We all love to wrestle with somebody about an idea. We've been talking with Bob Mann, who holds a Manship Chair in Journalism at the Manship School of Mass Communication at LSU, about his new book, Becoming Ronald Reagan, The Rise of a Conservative Icon. Bob, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week here in New Orleans. The Lakeshore Branch Library, 1000 West Esplanade in Metairie, hosts its final National Novel Writing Monday event, Monday, November 25th from 5 to 8:30 p.m. Chef Justin DeVillier signs the New Orleans Kitchen, classic recipes and modern techniques for an unrivaled cuisine. Saturday, November 30th at 10 a.m. at Garden District Bookshop. Sally Asher presents a story time with her book, The Mermaid's Night Before Christmas. Saturday, November 30th at 10 a.m. at the Hubble Library in Algiers. Don't forget to celebrate Indies First, Small Business Saturday, November 30th at your local indie bookstores. Contributor Shannon Sim signs Best American Travel Writing 2019, Sunday, December 1st at 3 at Octavia Books. And congratulations to Kalamu Yassalam, who will receive a Josephine Miles Award from Penn Oakland, December 7th in Oakland, for his book, Be About Beauty, published by the University of New Orleans Press. And congratulations to Houston writer Brian Washington, whose debut short story collection, Lot, has been named winner of the 2019 Ernest J. Gaines Award for Literary Excellence. This award will be presented to him January 30th at 6:30 at the Manship Theater at the Shaw Center for the Arts in downtown Baton Rouge. It's free and open to the public, though reservations are requested at gainesaward@braf.org. Now in its 13th year, the Ernest J. Gaines Award for Literary Excellence is a nationally acclaimed $15,000 prize given annually by Baton Rouge Area Foundation donors. It recognizes outstanding work from promising African-American fiction writers and honors the late Louisiana native Ernest Gaines' extraordinary contribution to the literary world. Gaines died November 5th at his home in Oscar, Louisiana, at the age of 86. Don't forget to listen in next Tuesday at 7:44 a.m. during Morning Edition and 5:44 p.m. during All Things Considered for our new series, Thinking Outside the Book. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org.